Today's episode of the Bill Simmons Podcast on the Ringer Podcast Network, brought to you as always by ZipRecruiter. The best teams start with great talent. Just look at the Philadelphia 76ers vaulting into contention last night, beating up the Celtics. The process, Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons starting to deliver. We're going to talk about that way later with my dad. No one knows the importance of talents more than ZipRecruiter. They deliver qualified candidates fast, so effective. 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. My listeners can try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/BS. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Meanwhile, did you not know all alcohol products are required to list their ingredients? Yeah, that was news to me. Bud Light is changing the game. They believe that we deserve to know our beer's ingredients, so they put an ingredients label right on their packaging. Bud Light, brewed with hops, barley, water, rice, no corn syrup, no preservatives, no artificial flavors. Find out what ingredients are in your beer. Bud Light, enjoy responsibly. We're also brought to you by TheRinger.com, the world's greatest website, where we are pumping out Game of Thrones content right now, trying to get you ready for when it comes back next month. Every day on the website, we've had a piece. Today, Alyssa Bearsnack wrote about, does Tyrion actually love Daenerys on Game of Thrones? Yeah, you can read that. You can watch our explainers that we started doing. The Binge Mode crew, they're counting down their 25 greatest moments. That started today. What was the 25th moment today, Kyle?
I got about halfway through, then Priscilla barged in. We did a pod, so I'm going to finish it up.
What was it though? What was the moment? Do you remember?
No, I don't know.
Well, Kyle enjoyed it. He doesn't know what he watched, but he watched half of it and he enjoyed it. A ringing endorsement from nephew Kyle. These are great, though. They're counting it down every day. They're meaty, as always. And we'll see what number one is. My personal number one would be the Red Wedding, but I don't think they'll pick that. They'll go deeper. They're savvier with Game of Thrones than I am. The Binge Mode podcast, by the way, subscribe to that as well, because they'll be coming back, obviously, when the show returns. And we have a whole bunch of other stuff planned, including our Twitter post-game show that we do on Sunday nights after the Thrones. That's coming back. Whole bunch of stuff. We have a lot of NBA draft stuff on the website as well. Our NBA draft guide has started again. And as you know, some people feel like March Madness is just an excuse to get ready for the NBA draft. I'm kind of in that camp at this point. I didn't even fill out a bracket this year. What am I going to do? Right now, as I'm taping this, Vermont is beating Florida State by one. I probably would have picked Florida State. I'd just be mad at myself. Now I've saved some money. I've saved some aggravation. But I am excited to watch Zion, Ja Morant, some of these guys change my opinion on RJ Barrett a million times. I like the guy in Gonzaga. That's how I look at the March Madness, as the feeder system to the National Basketball Association. We're going to talk about that later with my dad, who has just thrown his hands up with the Celtics season. But I'm putting that at the end of the podcast. First, we're going to talk to Ben Stiller. We've circled this podcast for a long time. It's finally happening. We dive into his entire career and a lot of the stuff that happened. And then there's some Knicks talk at the tail end. So get ready for that. First, our friends from Pearl Jam. All right, we've been circling this one for a while. Ben Stiller is here. He's not really promoting anything. He's just here because he wants to be here.
I got nothing.
Yeah. Well, you have an Emmy run like 6 months from now? Yeah. When is that? I guess 4 months from now.
It's a weird thing. Yeah, our show came out last November, I guess. So in the way, the cycle of things, it's for next year's, or this coming year's Emmys, which are way down the line, I guess.
Was it Escape at Dannemora or Escape from Dannemora? Because I always called it the wrong thing constantly.
Yeah, we had a debate about it. It was Escape at Dannemora.
Escape at Dannemora.
Yeah.
Actually, I loved it.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
I really did. I've talked about it multiple times. I'm in on all... I've been saying for years that there should be a cable channel called Bars with a Z, and it's just prison programming.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, channel 558 on Time Warner or something.
Right.
And it would just be all the prison movies and TV shows we've had. So I'm always in.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, there is a lot.
There's secretly a lot.
Yeah. And that was something, you know, I've never actually been like a super prison genre fan. Yeah. I do enjoy the occasional escape movie, but it's not like I was like obsessed with Escape from Alcatraz or anything like that.
It was like 8 hours.
Originally we had it as 8 episodes, and then we decided to make it 7 episodes and have the last one be a little bit longer.
One of the things I really liked about it was an every week show, which I think is becoming more and more of a lost art, where a lot of these shows now almost seem designed to get you to binge and to watch 3 or 4 at once. And this was not this was a really deliberate show that wasn't meant to be like that, which I appreciated.
Yeah, it was, you know, I mean, it was kind of, when we had the idea of it and we went around talking to different networks about it, we talked to Netflix and other streaming services. And, you know, I imagine if one of them had wanted to do it, maybe we would have done it that way.
Yeah.
But it worked out. And I think Showtime, you know, it's interesting because when you make those shows now and they all come out at once, it's challenging because, you know, there's all the attention is paid to it. You know, all the marketing kind of goes in for when it, you know, when it's streaming.
Yeah, it's basically 72 hours that you have to push it, and then it goes away.
And it's really, you know, which kind of reminds me of the way movies are now too.
Yeah.
You know, you get that opening weekend. But when you're on a network that shows it week by week, it ended up being a great thing for us because we were able to have the audience have a chance to find it. And it actually, every week would build in its ratings, which, you know, was a good sign for us that people were getting into it. But
and people could catch up after the fact. I think for like a site like the site we have, we just like it more when people do it that way. Like we have Thrones coming up now and we're treating it like it's the NBA playoffs, you know? And the cool thing is like each week is its own week of content for us. But when like Stranger Things comes out, it's all at once and we almost don't know what to do.
Yeah. How do you dole it out? How do you?
You can't.
Right? And everybody's you can't track different, how people are watching.
Right.
It.
Yeah. You might be on episode 5. I'm on 2. Yeah. Don't tell. There's a lot of don't tell me.
Sure. Yeah.
Wait. I'm not there yet.
Yeah. No, it's a really interesting thing because obviously it's changed the way people watch things, and that was never a question back in, you know, when we were growing up, that, you know, it was just you watch things when they, you know, like if there was a mini series that was going to be on like Roots or Shogun,
Rich Man, Poor Man. Yeah.
You know, that was like, oh my God, it's going to be 4 nights in a row.
Yeah.
And it was an event and it was a thing. I remember watching Roots and being like, this is just being like the most exciting thing. And then, you know, now it's all changed and it's actually made me think about it when we were making the show. I was wondering, well, wow, are people going to want to keep on coming back to this? Because it's not going to be there for them. They have to actually make the decision to want to keep on watching it. You know, obviously you have to do that when you're binging also, but it's kind of easier because it's also laid out the way, you know, Netflix or Hulu does it, where like the next episode like comes up before the credits are even over and you have to like make an active choice not to watch the next episode.
Right.
And, you know, so
or you start watching and fall asleep.
Right.
10 minutes in, then you have to wake up the next day. You're 3 episodes ahead.
It's also listening to podcasts if you're like in bed and you fall asleep and it's like in your subconscious. But I really thought about that. I was wondering like, will people want to come back for it? And it's almost a little bit more challenging in that way. You have to kind of trust that people are going to be into the vibe. And then also it's about prison and this world, which is pretty oppressive.
Yeah.
And I actually think that it's nice to be able to watch it and be in that world for a little while and then go away and have your life and then come back, because it's kind of like going to prison.
Yeah. I think that's why I like the prison.
There must be a critic who wrote that, but you know, it's a really heavy thing. So I think it's nice to be able to kind of like go in and out of it and wait for it.
And you had, some really good performances in it too. And Patricia Arquette is like almost unrecognizable, and that performance is insane.
Yeah.
I'd actually be surprised. I mean, I don't know who the competition is for her, but it's like she just kind of became a different person.
Yeah. It's interesting because I've known her for a long time. We did a movie a long time ago called Flirting with Disaster.
Yeah.
And
I was going to ask you about that later.
Yeah. And I love her. And we'd kind of stayed in touch, but, you know, not really seen each other a lot over the years.
Yeah.
And I just knew she would inhabit the role. And the biggest thing was, you know, she had to change her physicality and gain some weight. And I think that commitment from the beginning of doing that put her in a mindset where she just was a different person. And then she also is just a great actress. But it was funny because, like, I got used to her being Tilly, the character.
Yeah.
Because she just was that. And so when people started to see the show and they were so blown away, like, oh my God, I don't even recognize her. To me, it was like, well, that's just Patricia. Like, because that's who I've been with for the last, you know, 8 or 9 months. That she just was that. But, you know, she has no vanity as an actress. She's not thinking about anything other than being the character. And she's funny too. And she's, you know, she's, and as a person, she's really, generous. And I think that as an actress that you see that in her work, that she's just kind of there to be in the scene. And it's not about her.
Well, you accomplished something that always cracks me up when it happens, where by the last episode, I'm actually rooting for the guys.
Right.
And these are terrible guys. Yes. I'm like, no, no, go that way. Like, what the, no, don't stay in the cabin too long. It's something about escapes where you're just always rooting for bad people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, naturally they're going to be the protagonists, you know, cause you start to, you know, you're just watching them for that. And they're charismatic actors, hopefully, that you want to watch. But, you know, we felt it was really important to include that second to last episode.
The flashback.
Where you see what they did, because these were not victimless crimes that they committed.
Yeah. I was, from reading about you over the years, it always seemed like, I don't know if frustrated is the right word, but you kind of wanted to be a director, but you stumbled into being this A-plus list comedy star, but that wasn't necessarily what you expected was going to happen.
I think I semi-stumbled onto it. I mean, it's true. I always wanted to be a director since I was 10 years old. I love movies. And I did struggle, though, as I became a teenager and discovered, because my folks are in comedy.
Yeah.
But it wasn't what I wanted to do. I didn't want to do what my folks did because they were my parents and I wanted to be my own person. And I was struggling with that. But then I discovered the comedy that I connected with when I was a teenager and thought, oh, I want to do that. So I kind of was doing both. I was dabbling in both. And that's even when I was doing the shows that I did in the, you know, early 90s and
the MTV show.
Then the Fox show and, you know, working with all those great people in that world. I always felt like I was sort of not of that world because I wasn't as good at that. I really loved directing those shows. I loved, you know, directing the sketches. And that was, and always wanted to keep on directing and directing different kinds of things. And it just sort of, I kept acting also. But it was, you know, in the beginning, it was kind of after the Ben Stiller show on Fox was canceled. I directed Reality Bites.
Yeah.
But that was sort of, but I also did a part in it too. So it was kind of, but at that time, nobody was really hiring me as an actor. It was just, I happened to connect with Helen, the writer, Helen Childress, and we started improvising a little bit with this character. And she said, oh, you should play that guy. So it was kind of like, it just happened in that movie, but I came on that movie as a director first.
Yeah.
And then it sort of, I think, changed a little bit. And then when I started to do movies that people started to go to, and then it became a thing where that sort of would be like, oh, if you want to act in that movie, why don't you direct it all? If you want to direct it. And I was interested maybe more in the directing, but people were coming to me as an actor because that sort of drove everything.
Well, the TV shows, some of the stuff that you were trying that, like when you look back, you're aping the style of like certain things, which
totally.
That was the one advantage other than the fact that the cast was young and it was just, I kind of felt like that was more for, I was almost the age of who you were going for at that point. I was probably junior in college.
Right.
But you were aping a lot of the way things were shot. Whereas SNL was still a traditional, there is just a sketch show. They weren't kind of pushing the envelope with stuff like that. And you were doing a lot of tape stuff. And I actually thought that pushed SNL into, you know, trying to try more stuff eventually.
Well, they eventually did. I mean, I think that's the amazing thing about SNL is that it's lasted for 45 years or whatever. That Lorne has figured out how to do that. But, you know, that's a live show and that was just not what they were built to do.
Yeah.
You just couldn't do that. But they started to do more and more, you know, pre-tapes or little films.
Little commercials.
I mean, yeah. Albert Brooks was really the first person who did that for SNL. And that was what when I saw his stuff, that was what made me want to do what I did. And I wanted to do that at SNL. And that time they didn't really have the facility for it.
What featured member? What was it called?
Featured player and an apprentice writer.
But not for that long, right?
Because at that same time, I got the opportunity to do this MTV show. And it was precisely for that reason. I felt I wasn't good at being a live performer. And this was an opportunity to actually do to direct shorts and to be able to do it in that format.
And but that was when you were on that, whatever season that was, that was probably one of the most loaded casts they ever had.
Yeah.
And then you're just kind of randomly for six episodes.
You have to commit to being there. I mean, you know, it's a really, you know, it's a very specific environment and you have to work really hard to get your stuff on the air, which is, you know, just, it's always been the natural order of things. So, you know, when you go in there as a featured player or, you know, not as a main cast member, even as a main cast member, you still have to write your own stuff and you have to create it. And I just made the decision at that time that I would be better off for doing what I wanted to do to pursue that.
So did you tell Lauren that? You're like, I'm out? Nobody left that show when they were in.
Yeah, it was a crazy thing to do.
And he's like, maybe you should stay two more episodes.
I mean, Lauren is, you know, he's Lauren. It was a very hard thing to do. And over the years, we grew apart and then came back together. And now things are great. We're actually working on a movie together. And
well, you've made some cameos too.
Yeah. Yes, I have.
You've hosted it too, right?
Hosted like a couple times. Yeah.
When was the last time?
The last time I think was 2011 or 12, I think.
Maybe. You like doing that or no?
I find it stressful.
Yeah, I would imagine. Performing.
I really enjoy having takes. I like, you know, being able to do it over and over again.
So we did this podcast called The Rewatchables that people like, and we did Reality Bites a couple weeks ago, actually, because it was the 25th anniversary.
Yeah.
And one of the arguments was like, is this the Gen X movie? Because it was always like Reality Bites, Singles, Kicking and Screaming.
Yes.
You know, so we were like, we decided it was at least on the Mount Rushmore. And then basically whoever was in their 20s during that stretch, they kind of have their movie and it's not the right choice or the wrong choice.
Yes.
Reality Bites, I think, has aged the best out of all of them though, because it really does feel like a 1994 movie. A lot of the pop culture references that are in there and just the things people care about and the fear of AIDS and what do you do after you graduate college? It hits these themes that were really relevant there for 5-6 years, I think, in probably the best overall way of all those movies. But how do you feel about that now, 25 years later?
It's interesting because it's so long ago now that I feel like it was very much an indication of who I was then in terms of as a director and who Helen Childress, who wrote it, she was writing her life.
And she was in college at the time.
She'd like, I think just gotten out and, you know, she was writing her world. And so for me, I was coming at, I think it was a pretty honest point of view for me, because even for playing Michael in that movie, it was sort of where I was coming from as a person into that, you know, looking at that group of people. And we tried to incorporate that into the movie. But, you know, I was 27 or something. And so, you know, at that time, I think I thought I knew a lot more about everything than I do now, you know, and there's a certain confidence you have when you're younger to go forward and try to do things like that, make movies.
Yeah.
I know that because I'll look at, I see sometimes like B-roll footage of interviews that I did on the set and I'm like, who the fuck is that guy? what the hell did I think? I really thought I was the shit or something. Like it's crazy. And it's funny to look back at it now, but I'm at the movie itself. I haven't watched it for a while. I think I watched it maybe like 5 years ago and I'm going to watch it again because they're going to do it at the Tribeca Film Festival. We're going to do a screening.
Oh, cool.
And have everybody from the cast and Helen there. And do some sort of panel afterwards. But, you know, it, looking at it, it's just, you know, I look back at my choices as a director and things I would have done differently and things that I think, oh, that actually, you know, holds up in that way. But as a timepiece, I think for sure, you know, the movie, you know, the music and
the music the really held up. Yeah. Super big gulps instead of Starbucks. And all that stuff.
It's really interesting because, I mean, it's everything has changed so much since then.
Ethan Hawke was on here, I don't know, like 6-7 months ago. And he had said he just randomly watched it in a hotel room a couple months before he'd come on. And he was like, he did this whole impassioned, like, that's a good movie. Like he was really like proud of it. And he just hadn't seen it in a long time. That character, you know, he kind of became that character for a few years and then had to break out of it because it was such a distinct, powerful character.
Yes.
People just thought that was him. And then, you know, you got to break out of that whole thing.
But. Yeah. And also, you know, he'd been acting since he was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, right? Like Explorers and movies like
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I think.
And then he was the Dead Poets guy for a while. Right, and then right. you got to break out of that.
Yeah. And that was, I think, the same way that was me maybe at that point. That was closer to who he was at yeah. that time. So, you know, I think that's maybe also what it tapped into. And Winona also. You know?
Right.
And I think she saw, or at least an idea of, you know, of how she saw herself at that time, because, you know, she also was a huge movie star and she's the reason the movie got made when she said yes to it.
Right.
So everybody was kind of, you know, actually themselves in that film.
Yeah. So then you do Cable Guy.
Yeah.
Which I was reading something about you and they were saying like, after that movie, you were in movie jail, which I don't really remember that part. I actually liked the Cable Guy, but I think
I remember
it turned into a thing where... Where people were like, oh my God, Jim Carrey's making $20 million? Well, come on, that's ridiculous. And people were prejudiced to not like it immediately. And then it was a dark movie.
Yeah.
I liked it though. But I think now it belatedly people came around on it.
Yeah.
That probably didn't make it feel better at the time. But
it was an interesting experience. It's the first time I ever was in something that was considered a failure or a bomb or had antipathy, you know, aimed at it. From the press, not that I'd done that much or, you know, had been Reality Bites was sort of like, okay, you know, it didn't,
yeah.
I was so naive to the whole process back then too. Like when you haven't gone through it,
yeah.
you don't necessarily care about all that stuff as much in a way, because you're not aware of how much comes at you in terms of criticism or
yeah.
box office or all, you know, they're an idea out there, but when you're going through it the first or second time, it's different because you've never experienced it. So you don't know what to look for, what to care about.
Or what the red flags are.
Yeah, which is, I think, a good thing.
Yeah.
Because we never would have made Cable Guy if we really knew what, like, all those, you know, pitfalls in terms of making that kind of a movie as a summer movie. But it was Jim wanting to say, you know, I want to do this and wanting to take a chance. And he was so powerful that moment in time to just say, this is what I want to do. And then he chose to do something that was very edgy.
Well, he just had one of the great movie years of all time, right? He'd yeah. done Ace Ventura and The Mask right. and Dumb and Dumber all in one year. So whatever he was yeah. wanted to do, they were going to do it.
Yeah. And I remember the premiere and it was at the Chinese theater and like the lights came up. Sort of the people were, I remember, I think it was the director of maybe it was Ace Ventura or looking at me kind of like, what have you done? This look in his eye like, what was that? What, you've taken our beautiful Jim and what have you done to him? Because, you know, it was weird and it was dark. And
did he like it?
Who, Jim?
Yeah.
Jim loves it.
He was all in on it,
Jim
right?
loves it to this day. He yeah. loves it. Yeah. And I had the best time making it. Up until the movie opened, it was the best experience. And then when the movie opened, and I remember reading a New York Times review and saying, you know, the first disaster movie of the summer's come out. It's called right. The Cable Guy.
I really I do like, feel oh, like it whoa. Was 50% just his salary number coming out.
Well, they
it was like a scarlet
it.
Letter for it.
Yeah, they decided to announce it.
Yeah.
Almost pridefully that, you know, this was happening. And then I think it also just should not have been a summer movie. And
yeah.
And we didn't even know what the hell we were doing in terms of marketing or caring about marketing. I think if I had known more, I probably would have fought more to not have it be a summer movie. But I didn't know. And I probably wouldn't have made that movie, you know.
As we're talking about it, there's like a monsoon in Los Angeles right yeah. now, just pounding on our roof. The other interesting thing about that movie, belatedly, is that Broderick's playing what would then become like known as like the Ben Stiller part.
Yeah. Cause
that was like the part that, you know, you were the go-to guy for that part for, mm-hmm. I mean, you probably still are. How many times did you play variations of?
I can't even keep track. I don't know. yeah. I mean, it was before I had done that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
but now looking back, it's like, it's just weird that you weren't in it with Jim Carrey. It seemed like that would have made more sense.
But I mean, that goes back to, you know, directing and for me and, like I was so happy directing that movie. I wasn't even thinking about wanting to be in it. And it never was a thing for me wanting to direct and act at the same time. It just evolved that way.
Kyle, we're not picking up the rain on the...
We are so picking up the rain.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's kind of romantic.
It
like
really it. Is.
We're totally picking up every drop.
This is bizarre.
I guess let's talk about...
So then you worked David
O.
Russell.
In Cold Blood. You meant the rain shot in Cold Blood?
Hey, let's take a break to talk about DAZN. The old way of watching sports is over. Stream over 100 fight nights a year featuring the biggest names in boxing and MMA without the pain of pay-per-view. Fighters like Canelo Alvarez, Triple G, Daniel Jacobs, Anthony Joshua, Michael Venom Page, Rory McDonald, and a lot more. Behind-the-scenes content leading up to Fight Night, a library of classic fights, original programming, everything live on demand, available on almost any device. Download it on smart TVs, tablets, mobile, gaming consoles. Get access to the brand new MLB Live Whip Around Show, Change Up, on every night of the week. Jumping out of the best places they happen. Expert analysis from hosts with a fresh personality, and even Adnan Virk, old ESPN colleague. He's running the show there, that Whip Around Show. I'm excited for that show. Getting set up with DAZN is easy. Just download the app in the Apple or Android App Store. Sign up by creating an account. Then start watching across nearly any of your devices. DAZN, DAZN. Check it out. Back to Ben Stiller. David O. Russell, 96.
Yeah.
Flirting with Dizette. What'd you learn from him?
Wow.
You caught him early.
Yeah. I mean, David is a very, very creative and, you know, it's a roller coaster ride working with him. And I had not worked for a little while when I did that movie, and I read the script and thought it was so funny and met with him. And he was kind of like this mad genius sort of energy.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's part of what he did. I haven't worked with him since, but, you know, at that time, he was stirring the pot and getting people and looking for, you know, a way to kind of sometimes I think a movie set can get very sedate or gets very kind of like, this is the way you do it. And they set up the lights and the crew, you know, does their thing. And then the cast gets called in from their trailers. And it's sort of like, he, you know, the energy can be really kind of down or sort of like set. And he was all about like just mixing it up and getting right. people to, you know, be just like get their state to be something that's not necessarily like we're going to act now. And I think that's always worked really well for him.
When did you start having people improv on the set with stuff? Was that like when you were doing the TV shows? People try different ways of doing stuff and letting them go a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, we would do that on the sketch show for sure. You know, Judd Apatow.
Well, that was a big influence on him.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Oh. Yeah. There you go.
Cool. Well, I mean, we were doing that show together, the Ben Stiller show.
Yeah.
And Judd was, you know, writing furiously and producing at the age of whatever, like 24 or whatever. He was like, you know, arguing with the network and holding the line and just like he had it just innately in him.
Yeah.
To be a great producer. And he, would write stuff out, but then we would always play with it on the set because you wanted to try to, you know, come up with joke options or whatever. And then it sort of became a thing. And then in the movies for me, I remember doing it in Flirting with Disaster, there might've been some improvisation, but not that much. Or like, you know, and working with someone like Noah Baumbach, there's no improvisation whatsoever.
Right. He's like,
at all.
Do it's the
like
lines.
Word for word. But then, you know, doing like Meet the Parents movies or those kinds of things, there was a lot of, playing around. And then, or the Farrelly brothers was a whole other thing where, I mean, it's beyond even just improvising. It was just like, you know, weird, like people would show up that are like, you know, their kindergarten teacher or something would be doing a dramatic right. scene with you. Or, you know, it's just like, kind of like, that was just sort of like a free for all, you know?
That's an amazing movie. I actually thought that movie should have been nominated for an Oscar. William Goldman wrote that once. And I was like, he's right. That comedies never get appreciated, but that movie, it was so influential in the time. It was like, wow, what's this?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I have to say, I think that movie holds up.
Me too.
I came across it the other day and I was watching some of it and just, you know, it's just the tone of it is so much, it's just so much fun to watch it. And it just has such a good feeling about it. And the jokes are so flat out there, you know, they just go for it in a way that tonally it's just so consistent and I just enjoyed watching it outside of myself because I don't really enjoy watching myself, but like Matt Dillon,
There's a lot of people throwing their fastball in that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Cameron Diaz is outstanding
Incredible.
In that movie.
Yeah, she's it's great.
Like, you know, her defining movie probably.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I think about making that movie or like being in Florida when we were doing that movie, I didn't know what the hell was going on with those guys because I really was questioning, like, they're just so loose.
Yeah.
Like, do they really know what they're doing? What's going on here? Because they were having
and
so
like
much.
Their cousins as their the bartender. Cousins,
everybody's
yeah.
in it. But they really just knew what made them laugh. And my memory is them like sitting by the monitor and just, you know, just having a great time. And when they laughed, they knew they were like, oh yeah, that's it. That's what Pete has such a great sense of is, and Bobby too. And they both work together and they do different things on the set. But, Pete was always just really confident when something made him laugh that was, and he made you feel like you could just try anything and go yeah. for it.
Did you think that movie was going to blow up like it did?
I had no, because at that point I'd never been in a movie that had really blown up.
Right.
So I did have a sense that it would be really funny. When I read the script, I remember thinking and calling my agent saying like, this thing could either be like one of the funniest movies ever, or just be horrible because these jokes are just, you know, they're just like, if you don't pull them off, they're just going to be really embarrassing and bad. But you know how it came out, right? Like in terms of like the way it built up.
It was summer of 98. I remember that.
Yeah. But it didn't open at number one. It opened.
Oh, it was like 3 weeks
middle.
Later. Yeah.
It was actually, I think it was, you could check it, but I think it was like 8 or 9 weeks later.
That's when it became
that it
number
finally,
one?
Finally got to number one. Yeah.
Yeah, that would like never
grew,
happen now.
And the chairman of Fox at the time brought me into his office like 2 months after it came out. He said, I want to show you something. And he showed me this chart. He's like, this is how most movies open, you know, opening weekend, you go down by 50% now. And he showed me something about Mary where it just kept on steadily going up and up and up and then finally got to number one. And he said, just that never happens.
Yeah.
And you know, nowadays there's movies don't have a chance for that to happen because of the way that things come in and out of the theaters and the need that the theater owners have to make money in terms of, you know, what people watch. And obviously people are watching, they're not going to movies like that anymore. And, you know, in terms of the box office. So
it's much harder to get into that. You got to see that word of mouth vortex that every movie really wants to get into. I remember it happened with Get Out, even though Get Out was marketed really well, but it still at some point turned into a movie where you almost felt inadequate if you hadn't seen it because everyone else was talking about it.
I think you're right. That's like maybe one of the few times it's happened recently. Yeah. And that, you know, maybe it's because, you know, the window for when things get on television or streaming is so soon now that people, like my son is not really into going to the movies. He's 13. And even a movie that he wants to see, he's like, I'll just wait till it comes on Apple TV.
I know.
Yeah. Because it's coming on really soon on Apple TV. You know right. what I mean? And back then, that wasn't happening. So you really did have to go to the theater. And then there was that communal experience that people get in a horror movie, which people still go for horror movies. But I remember watching There's Something About Mary in a theater with people and just like a full house of people laughing. It was really exciting and fun. And that
was a really fun movie theater experience, which I think is its own version of a movie category. Because Get Out was like that, too. It was just fun to see it at a movie theater.
And I remember going to see The Matrix and having that feeling, too.
Yeah.
You know, and it just was a different thing going to the movies. I don't know if that was also a different time or also just a different age when, you know, that was a thing that we would do more. I don't know.
Well, now, the way they try to get people to come to a movie is basically the movie is so... You know, it's like Captain Marvel or something where you want to see in the movie because it's meant for the big screen. It's just better to watch it here than on your 50-inch TV, right? Horror movies, same thing. Come here. It's more fun to be scared with a whole bunch of people. Like Us is coming out this week.
Right.
I want to see in the theater because it's more fun to be with 200 people who are all scared at the same time. But for the most part, a lot of these movies, I'm like your 13-year-old son. I would just rather wait. I'm like, I'll wait 2 months. I don't
care. And I am too. But I went to see Halloween in the theater.
Yeah, me too.
And I really enjoyed that, you know? It was really fun. But yeah, I don't know what to say. I mean, obviously the superhero movies and those huge event movies have become what people go to the movies for. It's kind of hard with comedies these days.
So that movie comes out for you in 98. But you also have Your Friends and Neighbors in 98, which is which I ride for. That's one of my favorite weird indie movies.
Because
it's got that crazy Jason Patrick scene.
In the steam room?
In the steam room. He's talking about how... I didn't want to talk about it, but that movie's crazy. So you have that one and then this one at the same time.
I did four movies. I remember...
you did Permanent Midnight too, right?
I did four movies in 1997. Zero Effect, Jake Kasdan's first movie. And then I did Permanent Midnight. And then I think Friends and Neighbors. And then There's Something About Mary.
Because I was watching it from afar going, is he trying to get serious on us? And then you made There's Something About Mary. Right. It's like, all right, we're good.
I was just trying to work.
Yeah.
I had no
I didn't know I was
plan.
Living in Boston. I didn't know what your motivations were.
I was just happy to get jobs. And Permanent Midnight, you know, I was excited about playing that role and it was because it was totally different and I really enjoyed it. But I, you know, I also was really excited to do Mary too. So I guess I should have had more of a master plan, but at that time I was still sort of transitioning. It was an interesting, I don't know, time because it wasn't like I was one thing or the other. And I, you know, Reality Bites had done that too. And as a director, so it was just, and then when Cable Guy came out and didn't do great, it really was harder to put together a project as a director in that world.
Now after There's Something About Mary, you realize, all right, this is your agents are telling you,
well,
hey, you should do comedy movies. There's a lot of money here.
Yeah. I mean, then it was like literally people were then offering me movies as an actor to star in.
Yeah.
And that was the first time that ever happened. But I'd been, you know, doing it for since whatever, 80, you know, 9 or whatever. So I'd been around for a while.
So when did you really have the leverage to make whatever movie you wanted?
Well,
like Zoolander?
I mean, I think it was after There's Something About Mary when I made a couple movies that didn't do great, but yet I still was able to make movies as an actor. I mean, it's a